This is a Broad Pods production.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
This is Broad Radio. For you, by you. Broad Radio. Here for more.
Hello and welcome to Broad Radio On The Go, another cracking show full of wonderful women and amazing stories and things to make you feel good. Joe and Nellie Thomas are hosting this episode and their guests are writer Catherine Devney. She's got a memoir called True North, and she really taps into the ideas of things ending when it comes to relationships and how we need to embrace that. Chelsea Bonner is the CEO and founder of Bella Management, and she is behind Australia's first plus-sized catwalk show at Australian Fashion Week. Joe and Nellie are talking about how to have a positive relationship with yourself while living with a chronic illness when they talk to Michelle Irving. They're also talking about Nellie's experience with post-lockdown plane travel and the very big question for many, many people: are screen time rules a load of BS?
Hello and welcome to Broad Radio. I'm Jo Stanley, and grinning next to me here is the delightful Nellie Thomas. Well, it's so awesome to have you, doll.
Jojo, I was just thinking we don't dance like we used to.
No.
God, I love that song.
I do too.
Isn't it beautiful?
Bro, who is that artist again? Oh my gosh. That singer.
Oh, she's the beautiful Cleo, and she performs under the name Medley. So go look her up. Her work is just fabulous.
Like, follow, all the things.
All the things.
We do love it. And she was very kind to let us use that song.
Yeah, it's
so
beautiful.
Yeah, love, love, love. Hey, here we are for Broad Radio again. Nellie Thomas, comedian, writer. Awesome to have you next to me. And we've already been giggling along. It's school holidays, so if you are juggling that nightmare, we're thinking of you, because let me tell you, I'm very happy to be working out of home today.
Well, I mean, I sort of feel a bit jelly of you in general, because you work out of the home a lot more than I do. But school holidays does exacerbate that feeling of Alcatraz.
Well, but just the guilt, because when I work from home, I have work to do, but that means my daughter is on the screen literally an entire day.
Yeah.
Because I'm not engaging with her.
Mate, she's loving it.
I know.
She's loving it sick.
Yeah, but it's terrible parenting, apparently.
You know,
you're supposed to be out doing activities and all that sort of stuff.
I grew up on, you know, F troop and a country practice and multiple hours of screen a day, and I'm bloody fantastic.
Look at you now.
Look at me now.
You've never looked back.
Are you a rewatcher of shows?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah, me too. I find that very comforting if I love a series. Especially in COVID times, just to go, I don't need anything new. I'm just going to rewatch whatever it is.
Well, do you know, I think it's because otherwise you spend as much time scrolling through Netflix, through Stan, through Disney. You could have watched an entire series in that time.
In the and you've got RSI time. By the end of it.
So I might as well go back to Friends. It never fails.
Is that what you go back to?
Always.
Always, because it's a little comfort thing.
I love it.
I go back to the West Wing. That says a lot about
do
both
you?
Of us. Yeah. It's
How
not
is
that,
that
hardcore.
Relaxing?
Well, I've got a degree in politics.
Oh, la-di-da.
You know. Well, it hasn't done any good. But, you know, I like that stuff.
That's like a name drop. I have a degree in politics and gender studies. Are you going to throw that in?
I do as well.
Oh, look at me with a drama and theatre studies degree. Where has that got me?
Well, look, and we're in the same place.
It's true.
So, you know, I don't consider that a name drop, but sure, let's take it.
So how's your school holidays going?
Oh, look, mixed. I mean, I tried to do we're not post-COVID, but I don't know what to say, you know, post-restriction holiday. So the first holiday we've done in a couple of years. And I've got two kids, but I just took the teenager. I thought mum and teen time.
gorgeous.
Her and I will go to Sydney. We'll stay in a nice hotel. There'll be a buffet breakfast. There'll be a musical. And Jetstar cancelled our flight.
Oh.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, mate.
With how much notice?
Couple of hours.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, a couple
thanks.
Of hours.
Thanks
yeah.
for that.
Yeah, so that was really relaxing.
Oh, heartbreaking. Did you get there?
We did get there. We missed numerous activities and the first night, and they wouldn't refund the hotel, but don't get me started on that. But the most difficult part of it, I think, was, you know, for lots of people, including my teenager, she was really anxious to go because we haven't been doing this stuff. Like, we have been sort of de-skilled a little bit in terms of, you know, venturing outside, not just our house, but in this case, outside our state, and going to the airport, and the airport was full on and blah, blah, blah. So that was the difficult part, was kind of managing my anxiety and her anxiety and the disappointment.
Yeah.
But we got there in the end. We saw 9 to 5, which I highly recommend.
I've heard it's amazing.
It was absolutely fabulous. Casey Donovan's a queen. Eddie Perfect, of course. We had nice meals. You know, I'm glad we did it.
Yes.
Yeah, but it was tricky.
Well, you have a lot less guilt than I do with this school holidays, really. Oh, we took my daughter to the dog beach. We've done some
That's
things.
Lovely.
Yeah. Went and saw an amazing exhibition at the National NGV in Melbourne, the queer exhibition.
Yeah.
Oh, it's beautiful.
So good. All right. I've got to put that on the list.
You've got to check that
Can
out.
Can I assuage your screen guilt a little bit or at least complicate the idea? So there's a fabulous woman called Christy Forbes who I am part of her support network because I have an autistic child and she's an autistic advocate. And in short, she talks about the calming effects of screen time for a lot of neurodivergent kids.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, screen time rules were not made for our kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's an assumption in the screen time rules of a quote unquote normal child, whatever that means.
Yeah.
Usually, frankly, a middle class white, able-bodied, whatever, all the things child. And that is just not all children.
Well, also, you know when people say, oh, when we were growing up in the 80s, you know, we were always out on our bike and we were playing in the street till dark and all this sort of idyllic notion of what our youth was, right? If we had YouTube, as if we wouldn't have been
as
inside 24/7.
But also, I'm sure you, as soon as we got a VHS player, which one of my uncles gave us, we watched movies, you know, whenever we were able to. Like, we watched hours of TV a day.
Yeah,
The
only reason I wasn't doing that was because my mum wouldn't let us watch what we wanted to watch. Because the parents were the boss of the telly.
Right.
You know, like, you watched what they watched.
Oh, totally.
It wasn't like you got to choose as a kid.
I watched Prisoner, mate.
Seriously,
as a primary school kid, it was my favourite thing ever.
Yes.
So, yeah, this sort of, you know, the good old days weren't that good.
No.
Like, for real.
Mm.
But, I mean, obviously there's a line. Like, you don't want 15 hours of screen time a day school holidays. I mean, you probably do. But, you know, this idea that kids are going to do half an hour a day, I mean, I just don't know anyone who actually applies that. It's such, you know, BS, I think.
Well, even if, right, on the days where I'm like, okay, work's away, it's you and me today, babe, we have activities planned. They last an hour.
Yeah, that's right.
The days are long.
That's right.
They're so long.
But what do you do at night when you're tired?
You watch the telly.
You watch telly.
Yeah.
So, I mean, everyone's got to calm their farm a bit on this stuff, I reckon. Mm.
You've been out seeing comedy festival shows.
Oh, I have. It's. I mean, I know people keep saying this, but I think it's worth repeating, you know, as a live performer, the last couple of years have been diabolical, frankly, and it's so delightful. I'm not doing a show in the comedy festival, but that's even more delightful for me because I can actually go and watch stuff and enjoy it and not be thinking about my own, you know, nightmare existence. So I've been going and seeing stuff, and it's just really lovely to be in an audience. It's lovely to see my colleagues working. It's really nice to feel a bit normal. I mean, you still sit there kind of going, who's got a mask on? Is anyone coughing? Mm. You know, all of that kind of stuff. But it's just, I've just found it so uplifting, even just being in the city.
Yes. It's
you
great.
Know, do you want me to mention a couple of shows?
Sure.
A couple of recommends.
Yeah.
So one of my favourites is Tina Del Twist, Caravan in the Sky, which is Wes Snelling doing a beautiful show. He does a cabaret character called Tina Del Twist. So a mixture of song and story and stand-up. Beautiful, beautiful show. Loved Ursula Carlson, of course, which, you know, everyone will know who Ursula is. Damien Callinan's show, Double Feature. Oh, I actually cried.
Oh, you know, when you go, an amazing writer, isn't he?
It's so beautiful. It's a tribute to his parents and a kind of reimagining of, you know how you forget, and my kids have done this, they forget that you forget your parents had a life before you existed. Mm. He's gone back through their diaries and recreated their life. And there's a couple of moments, which, I mean, this doesn't sound like a good sell, sorry, Damo, but there's a couple of moments he cries.
Oh, wow.
You know, and it's just beautiful. What else have I seen?
I'm going to say Double Feature is a ripping title for show about your parents.
Isn't it? And it's so wonderful because he actually has been able to document his mum's suitors, right? So via her diaries, all of the men that she could have married.
Wow.
And he kind of does, I won't give too much away, but he does a table of the men and sort of, you know, short and long odds. of what could happen. And I just absolutely adored it. But being in the city, seeing people happy.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, you know, I normally go to bed at 9. Like, I'm an old nana, but I feel, like, invigorated. Yeah. I really do.
I do recommend going out. I've seen Kirsty Wiebeck, Silver Linings. Yeah. Beautiful. Loved it. I said in my little, you got to do a Twitter review. And my Twitter review was that this is a comedian at the top of her game. Like, she's sharp.
Kirsty's amazing. I've seen all of her shows. Sharp. Yeah, she's amazing.
Double Feature, love that as a title for a comedy festival show. Silver Linings for Kirsty. That works, you know, because you instantly go, I'm in for a good time there. tell me a title of a comedy festival show you've done.
Oh, so you and I have discussed this before. One of the difficult, this is like showing you how to make sausages, but you have to give your title a good 6 months before you do the show.
Yes.
And you've never written the show 6 months before you do it. No. So it can resemble, like have no resemblance to the actual show. What have I done? Probably my favourite. No, I've done Family Ties. And then I had to, it was a loose sort of pun on the TV show Family Ties. And it was me imagining how I might have turned out differently under three different circumstances and I played different characters.
Oh, I like that.
No, you tell me yours while I'm thinking.
Oh, well, the last solo show I did was called Prettier in Person. Every single person used to say to me when they'd meet me,
really?
Oh, you're so much prettier in person. And I'd be like, I work on radio, so how do you actually know that?
Do you know how many times someone has said to me, thinking that I'm going to enjoy it as a compliment, oh, geez, you're not as fat as you look on TV. thank you.
Anyway, naming something can be tricky. I've often thought about what I would name my memoirs, which I have not written yet and probably will never.
What's your front runner title?
Hit and Miss.
Yeah.
I bring it up because I have just finished reading, and we have to introduce our first guest because she's amazing and we don't want to run out of time with her. But I've just finished reading True North. It is a memoir by Catherine Devaney, and I absolutely loved it. Could not put it down. She joins us now. Hi, Catherine.
Hi. It's great to be here.
Oh, it's so lovely to see you, and thank you for your memoir. It was just, it is so beautifully written, and it is about the end of your 17-year relationship.
70-year, that would be quite a thing.
17-year relationship with a father of your children, but it's really heartwarming and beautiful and sort of uplifting as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's funny the way the blurb goes, because I actually think it's got more to do with class than anything else.
Yeah, I agree. Mm. I do agree. And
I think you don't hear enough written about class in Australia. And I don't think I've read or come across anything written about class by a woman, and particularly by a woman who grew up poor. Normally, memoirs are around gender or race, but very rarely about class. It's interesting with a book, though, I think it probably is a sign of a good book, particularly as a writer. This is my 10th, so the first nine are the hardest, which is not true. They've all been a delight. But when you write a book, so I originally thought that the book was about, when I split up with Mars, so Mars and I were together for 17 years, and when we split up, it was so full on and it was so exhausting, and I literally felt like I was dying and giving birth to myself every week. It was the worst thing I've ever been through. And I have, you know, had cancer, given birth without drugs, and also worked for Channel 7. So it was, you know, right up there. But so what was weird for me is, like, I had little kids and I would be talking to people at a party, and they'd generally be people my age. I'm 53 now. And I'd go, oh, yeah, you know, my partner and I just split up or whatever. And they'd be going, oh, yeah, yeah, I did that about 20 years ago when I had kids that age too. And I go, well, you know, what, how'd you do it? What happened? And they go, oh, we're fine now and we all have Christmases together. But no one ever showed me the stitching. Like, I was, how did I get here? You know, when do you know it's bad enough to leave? You know, what happens next? How do you feel? And so I think that originally when I set up to write it, because I've probably been playing with it for about 10 years, and I may have written about a million words to get it down to what I wanted. And I am a huge memoir buff. It's basically the only genre I read, or genre, as Channel 7 says it. it's the only genre I read. And I think that, I know that a memoir doesn't have to be, like, factually accurate. It has to be a true artistic representation. And a memoir only works as if it has a strong theme. So I thought that the theme was basically explaining all of the factors that get you into a relationship and the kind of relationship you end up in, why you stay, why things go pear-shaped, what makes you stay there while you get so exhausted and you just kind of run out of everything that you've got, energy, love, patience, perspective, then how, you know, why you leave and the courage it takes. But that's what I thought it was about. And it was, I gave the memoir, I don't get an advance. I just give the big lumps of manuscript to my publisher and I say, you know, please consider. And I gave it to them just before COVID. And the idea was that it was going to come out basically a year later. And then it was, because of COVID, it was pushed out to last July. And then the wheels fell off with the editor who was working on it, who was somebody who I really wanted to keep on it. And she said, I'm not going to get it finished. There's a million things that were happening, some COVID related, some not COVID related. And she said, I can pass this on to another editor, but I really wanted to work on this book. And I love this book. And I said, and she said, every fiber of my being says, let's hold off until March 2022. And because of, and I have to say, you know, I said, yeah, of course, people are more important than books. But I was really, really quite upset about it, because the year before I'd had to postpone, then cancel, then dismantle 30, you know, shows and performances that I'd put together. And so last year, the second year of COVID, I said, right, I'm going to try and run three of my writing workshops, retreats. So they're my weekend retreats, and everything else is going to be on Zoom, but at least I'll have the book out in the middle of the year. And I thought the worst thing that could happen would be that I would be launching by Zoom and not in real life. So it was pushed back until now, and there's no God, you know, I'm not into the universe or any of that kind of stuff. But one of the best thing that possibly happened, like, in my life, but to the book, was that my mum died about this time last year. So because mum died, when we were about to go to print with this in January and get it all together, a couple of the people who read it in at Black Ink said, oh, it ends a bit abruptly. And they had ideas about how it should finish. And my partner and I had something called a love party, because I'm, you know, totally against marriage. We had basically a wedding, but with no God, no government. And they said, why don't we finish with that? And I thought, every fibre of my being says, no, that's too tied up with a bow. And it just didn't feel right. And I said, look, I've got an idea of how to end it, but I don't know whether I'm a good enough writer to do it. But if you give me a week, I want to give it a crack. So I ended with a chapter about the death of my mum, which not only made the book, I think, three times better, but changed what I thought it was. It wasn't about, you know, to me, it's not about breaking up or even hard times. It's about the fact that we're constantly splitting up with parts of ourselves, where we live, how we see ourselves, our body, what we eat, our values, and that we need to normalize some splitting up with. We quite know, oh, yeah, we're changing jobs. I'm changing haircuts. I'm a vegan now. You know, I'm gender fluid, whatever that is. And some things we're better at coping at than others. You know, oh, I don't believe, I don't, you know, barrack for that football team anymore. I'm an atheist now, you know, or I wasn't going to have kids and I'm going to have kids now, you know, whatever that is.
I just want to pick up on that because I think, you know, it's a really interesting challenge to the predominant narrative about divorce or separation, you know. And I think, as you know, like, I've also come out of a long-term relationship, and one of the things that I am really trying to challenge in my public life and personal life is the idea that that relationship was a failure, or that our family is broken. We're the same family in two different houses, and frankly, we're all happier. So can you just speak to that?
I totally agree. Oh, I'd love to. So, Nelly, if we lived until some things are so sticky, you know, in the way I said that we're used to splitting up with some things, I just want to just end that with saying we need to normalize splitting up with members of our family, blood or, you know, by relationship. We need to normalize splitting up with, you know, children, siblings, parents, partners. The idea that it is somehow a failure is insane, and it shows how insidious all of the pressure is for people to stay in particularly heterosexual and particularly nuclear families. It benefits the patriarchy, capitalism, and the economy by doing this. If we lived until we were 300, we wouldn't assume that relationships were forever. That it's so bizarre. Like, you don't think about changing where you live or the job that you have or your occupation as any, or even the way you eat, you know, if you decide to become a vegan or you decide to go back to meat. The idea that a 17 year relationship isn't somehow a failure is bonkers. One of the, like, you just use the term divorce, separate. When you go through forms, it's really common to say, you know, marital status, which I can tell you right now for free, they don't need. They do not need a marital status. What they need is a next of kin. So marital status are things like divorced. How is something that you used to be a marital status?
Yes.
Divorced, separated, you know, like, it's just bizarre that they are even terms that we use for people.
It's things a
that
relic, they used to isn't be. It? It's a relic.
But it's a relic's a perfect example. Yeah, Joe.
But Catherine, I think having read your book, and I was so moved by the notion that you were choosing to be happy. And I think a lot of the reason that we struggle with separation from a relationship is that we're not entitled to say, hey, I'm not happy and I'm going to make a choice that makes me happy. Because everybody goes, oh, but you're going to, what about other people that are unhappy because you've done that? But it's my life. Let me choose what's going to make me happy.
That is coming from a really privileged position, and I totally agree, because I'm coming from a privileged position too. Even though, you know, I was brought up working class, I have no savings, no super, no boss, no job, no worries. But we are so trapped into the idea of, you know, the family and relationships by financial constraints, social constraints, familial constraints. They don't make it easy, Joe and Nelly, for us to split up. They do not. There is no reason that we all can't have safe housing and there can't be a universal basic income. I read something the other day. If Jeff Bezos spread all of his money out amongst all the people in the world, we'd have all over $1 million each, including newborn babies. So I wrote about this in the book, you know, when Miles and I split up, and I just want to, people, and particularly, you know, and it was always mums at the school, and they didn't necessarily know me very well, and they would sidle up and they basically said, how bad does it need to be to leave? Because the sunk costs of the relationship, it's just like, even if it's got down to only 1% good, you don't know if it's ever going to jump back to 98% good, or if it's 1% good, if you're going to leave that relationship and then it's going to go to 0% good. So it's not simply an emotional thing. It's a financial thing. You've set up a corporation. It's staggering and alarming and revealing how much society puts on us to stay in poor relationships, when we really, you know, there is no one benefits on a personal level, but the structures that benefit are religion, the patriarchy, the economy, and capitalism. So, you know, you said the choice to be happy.
I totally agree with you. I absolutely understand and acknowledge that it is a privilege to be able to leave a relationship and that many, many people can't.
Yeah.
I'm speaking from, you grew up in a Catholic family. I grew up in a Protestant Christian family. Like, you know, my parents were missionaries, that kind of sort of indoctrination. And it wasn't, it wasn't encouraged for us to make choices that were right for us. It just wasn't also encouraged.
Well, it's also completely countercultural, quite frankly, even in 2022, for a woman to say, it's enough for me to leave because this doesn't serve me. People want, he cheated, he was abusive. Yeah. It's not enough to just go, yeah, it just wasn't working for me.
Yep.
Guess what? That's enough.
There's so much there. I don't even know where to start. And I've had to live that recently with a few people close to me. Basically, they wanted to find, you know, somebody shagging in a bed, you know, their partner shagging in a bed, or blood and bruises, like even with the notion of what domestic, what violence looks like within a relationship. And I was so informed, and there have been so many people, and I'm so delighted that this book has landed the way that I want it to. And I am literally overwhelmed all day by people saying, this spoke to me, so I feel seen and I feel held. And they use the word gift a lot. And a lot of people say to me, I'm so glad the book landed exactly the way that I wanted to. I mean, I am a great, you know, recipient of amazing art. And when you are the writer, you're also the reader. When you are the artist, you're also the viewer. And so to be able to be on this side of the artistic transaction is as beautiful as sitting there and finishing a book and going, this was amazing. I never want it to end. So it just feels like the same transaction, just instead of being a top, I'm being a bottom, or vice versa. And a lot of people will say, well, that's the truth, you know. A lot of people will say to me, you know, we grew up in really similar backgrounds. I don't know why I didn't see what you saw. I didn't make the decisions. And to be frank, the whole notion of family and relationship, I only saw such terrible, terrible examples of these things. While they were still trying to sign me up to this rewards program, I just went, why on earth would I buy into this rewards program when I could have a life like you or you or you or you or you? So there was nothing. Perhaps if I had grown up and there seemed to be some rewards for me, you know, being a member of the kind of family, like in the castle, you know, we're poor, but, you know, we all barrack for the, you know, this football team, and every Christmas dad gets drunk and sings old Irish songs. I had the worst of the truth of poverty and the worst of the narrative of poverty, the worst of the truth of marriage, relationships, gender ideas, and, you know, and both the truth and the narrative. So I just kept questioning. But in saying that, not all the members of my family did. Actually, I think it's fair to say that I'm the only one who did question. I just went, this sucks. And I have spent, you know, I'm bipolar, I'm dyslexic, I'm not, I really don't have many great skills, but my skills are optimism and seeing the truth.
I'm going to step in there and challenge that idea that you don't have many great skills. I think we have to wrap up.
Yes.
But I do want to say, as someone with also a working class background and who was not destined to be a writer in the same way that you are, it is actually really important for people to see someone like you write. And someone, especially with the challenges of dyslexia and bipolar as well, it is really important for people to see that these are options that are available, because those things are not always apparent to us as kids, even now in 2022. So bravo to you.
Yeah. And might I say, so firstly, the book is amazing. Do get... loved it so much. Yes. And if you grew up in the 70s and 80s, I tell you what, you have you have got an encyclopedic memory of
she
all
does,
of the things
she?
That we watch and we watched and what we wore and the places we went. And I also grew up in the northern suburbs. So I was just like, yes, all of this was my childhood. And so I loved that. But check out Catherine's Gunner's workshops, all of the writing workshops. My sister did your workshop, actually, and loved it.
And I've been one of the guest speakers at these. and I can tell you they're fantastic. So I get onto those, especially if you think you might want to write.
Yeah.
And you think you don't have the confidence, or as Catherine would say, I'm going to do it. No, do it. Go and do the class.
I think it's really beautiful that you empower others to write, Catherine.
Yeah.
Well, there's Nellie, can't wait to have you back. I mean, COVID is just like, we're only starting our Gunners again back in May. And they're a bit low. You know, people are reluctant. They want to do the Zoom ones and they want to come to the weekends. But the idea of like a day in a room with people, but people are warming up more to that. And I think that people are so unused to putting money into something and setting a date aside. There is a great saying by Toni Morrison, and I've got this in the front of my book, Use Your Words, which is the purpose of freedom is to free other people. And that's how I feel about writing, and I don't think it's something that I just want to do, and I want to have my books and I want to go, yeah, I've got my books, but you know, it's not for you. It's just the platforming of certain people in our history, whether it's art or politics or religion or whatever, has just been a way to discriminate and to push down other voices that it's not about needing to be heard. We do need to hear them, but we want to hear them. I'm very, very proud of the book. Thank you so much for having me. And it's all gorgeous. So
you
thank
too, you. Darling. All power all to gorgeous. You. All
Thanks
power
so much,
to you.
Catherine.
Thanks for coming.
See you.
Ciao.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
I was very excited to read last week that for the first time, Australian Fashion Week are going to be hosting, or they have scheduled, a plus size parade. And the woman behind the parade is Chelsea Bonner, who is a size inclusive pioneer, I'm going to say. She is the founder and CEO of Bella Management. And she joins us now. Hi there, Chelsea.
Hi, Chelsea.
Hi. How are you?
Can I start the questions? Because I'm the plus size of the duo here.
Okay.
Let's be frank. Yes. Chelsea, can I have two completely indulgent personal questions? Right?
Go for
First
it.
One is it too late for me to be a plus size model?
No, it's never too late.
Great. Second one is, so I'm size 18. Where should I shop? Because I'm sick and tired of wearing old lady clothes that I sweat in, especially when I'm on stage. They're all white. What is with plus size clothing and synthetic fabric?
I don't know. I mean, we've got, I'm just thinking about just the designers, for instance, in the show that we're doing. There's heaps of cottons and linens, and so I don't know where you're shopping, but I think
it's a good point. Where are you shopping?
Oh, you're putting this back on me. Thank you so much. All right. Well, give me some names. Come on. Give me some designers.
For instance, we've got 710 Sundays, Embody Women, Harlow do beautiful linens, actually. I was just touching all of their fabrics the other day. Kerry has got a particular eye for fabrics. And, and then there's, you know, some really beautiful labels like Noble Kind, which is a startup in Melbourne, which is just beautiful, beautiful fabrics and beautiful tailoring. They are out there and they're around. If you prefer sort of a boho feel, maybe Vagary, who's also in the show. So, I don't know.
Because Chelsea, you know this is a thing, right? Like, this is a thing. Yeah. You can search for, that one of the difficult things about being plus size is trying to find brands that make clothes that suit your personality as well as your body.
Yeah. I think this is the problem. There's not as broad a range of yes. clothing. And, you know, people often say to me, why fashion? You know, why do I put sort of all of my activism and advocacy into fashion? And it's because fashion is the outward representation of how we feel inside.
Yeah.
And that's how we present to the world. So,
yeah. And I don't feel like a rayon top.
Yeah. You don't feel like a rayon top.
That's not how I
feel.
We'll sort you out.
You know what I'm saying? But I love what you're saying there, Chelsea, because, and I love that you direct your advocacy and activism towards fashion, because for so long there have been gatekeepers that have excluded not just people who are of different size and shape, but people who are a different age, people who are differently bodied, able-bodied. Yep. It's an industry that, you know, we're drawn to is, I love fashion, but I don't see myself in it. And I love that you are there. Assisting all of us to maybe feel like it's more accessible.
And we've all got to buy clothes.
Yes. Well, that's, you know, fundamentally we all have to buy clothing, but then fashion's more than that. You know, there's places you can go to buy clothes if you are just looking to wear something today that covers your private bits. You know, there's places you can go for that. But, you know, as I was saying before, fashion really is personality. It's we show up the way we want people to see us, the way we want to be, the way our personality is inside, you know, and we do that through fashion, through the prints we choose, through the jewellery we choose, through the shoes we choose, through the makeup we choose, you know, that's why it's so important. And yeah, a lot of people miss that connection, particularly men, I have to say, you know, really miss the emotional connection to fashion and beauty for women.
Yeah. And the creative expression, I'm seeing it in my daughter since she could walk, she's dressed herself and her creative expression in what she chooses to put on is a joy to behold. Yeah. Can you please speak to this incredible milestone that Australian Fashion Week are running this parade that you are behind, and you say even 5 years ago this wouldn't have happened. Why is that?
No, there has been a massive shift over the last couple of years. I think it's the, you know, this new generation of sort of 18 to 25 year old women who listened to us when we said to them, please don't let anyone put you in a box. Don't let anybody judge you by the size of your body. They understand more about genetics than ever before. They just understand more about the world, and they really hate being sold to. I mean, I hate being sold to, but they really don't, you know, they're not tolerating anymore being told who they are because of the body that they were born into. Yeah. And where, you know, in our generation, and I'm, you know, I'm 48, so I'm a little bit older, we were told that we were stupid, we were lazy, we would never get ahead in life, we were not worthy of beautiful things, we were not worthy of bothering to buy nice fashion because nobody would care anyway, unless we were thin. And so, you know, there's not just me, there's a lot of us that have been fighting against that for 20 or more years. And this younger generation now, you know, my niece particularly, she's, you know, she's a curve girl herself. She's tall and probably a size 14 or so. She's extremely fit, and she wears her short shorts, and she wears her, you know, spaghetti strap dresses and things that I would just never have had the courage to wear at that age because of the amount of shaming.
Oh, Chelsea, it's so true. So my daughter's 14, and I see her friends of all different shapes and sizes, and, you know, some of them have got bellies and stretch marks and all the things that, you know, happen when you go through puberty, and they're in bikinis and they've got their little short. I would have had a giant Fido Dido T-shirt. I would have been begging to not go to the swimming carnival. I would have been on a diet of Tab every other day. Yep. The amount of shame and damage that I did to my body and mind at that age. And I think it's not done, but it is changing. For sure it's changing.
It is
because of people like you, frankly.
Oh, thank you. Well, I mean, I wrote a book a couple of years ago. It was called Body Image Warrior, and I feel like it explained why I do what I do and why we needed to change it and how hard the fight's been. Mm. But the great thing is that everyone who's read it or listened to somebody who's read it has changed. And yep. I just love saying, when my niece walks in with a little dress on, I just cheer silently inside. I want to hug her, same. You know, I get so excited.
Yep.
But for her, it's just so normal. But for us, for our generation, it's just a sense of pride. When I see any woman's body anywhere and someone's just walking down the street wearing whatever the hell they want to wear, I just am cheering inside all the time.
Even the fact they've got that phrase, like I'll hear my daughter and her friends, if someone does make some sort of comment, kind of go, we don't do fat shaming.
Yeah, I love it.
You know, we never had the phrase fat shaming. No. I was just ashamed.
No.
Do you know, and it is remarkable. So my daughter's been watching Kath and Kim.
Yeah.
And she loves it. It's amazing. But it then tipped over to a special that at some point someone had done where it was one of those clip shows where they were playing clips of Kath and Kim and had people commenting on the show.
Mm.
And it was people like Alex Perry and various other people. I can't remember. He stood out in my mind just because I love his clothes, right? But non-stop fat shaming. Non-stop throughout.
Acceptable. Like,
yeah. All of them were making comments about how, you know, Kim had a muffin top and all this sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, my gosh, I can't even believe this is happening. My daughter switched off. She said, this is not, I can't.
Good.
I can't do
good
that.
Good girl. No.
But so you've been around 20 years, Chelsea. You would have seen the damage that happened.
Well, longer. Back in the ye olden days, I was one of the first curve models in Australia. So before I opened Bella, I was very, very active in the plus size community and curve community. But, you know, so probably more like 30 years I've been around for now, which is a bit terrifying.
So what kind of resistance have you faced then over the time?
I mean, I think every kind of resistance that you can think of, really, the fight to be acknowledged and to make what was so normalized, you know, fat shaming and you have to be on a diet and the way you should look and diet culture in general was so overwhelming. It was so normalized that you should be ashamed of yourself, that you deserve to be ashamed of yourself. To unpick that for myself and then try to help unpick that for everybody else, not just on the ground level amongst friends and family, but in boardrooms, in keynote speeches to 500 male heads of marketing departments. You know, I mean, to try to explain it through numbers, through emotion, through every possible way you can attack this problem and break it down so that people can have, you know, what Oprah calls the aha moment, so that, you know, I can find a way to get to them so that they go, oh, that's why it's wrong and that's why we shouldn't be doing this. Or, you know, just have some understanding of basic genetics, really. I mean,
Actually, can I pick up on that, Chelsea, because you've mentioned genetics a couple of times, and I think one of the things, it's actually happening very slowly, but one of the things we're starting to understand now, which anyone who's been fat understands, I look around and I go, oh, I look like all my aunties. And I look like my mum and my cousins and whatever, and we all eat differently. But there's still this persistent idea that I heard on the radio this morning, someone talking about diabetes. It was a doctor and he said, loving the dog, and he said, I'm talking about type 1 diabetes, not the one that's caused by lifestyle problems. In other words, you know, not the fatties who overate and got themselves – you know, type 2 diabetes. So there's still this like combination of genes and lifestyle is still not understood. You know, we're still assuming you look at someone's body that's not size 10 and think they don't exercise and they overeat.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, it can't be further from the truth. And there's been so many studies done about it now. One of my closest friends had a mild heart attack last week. He's fine, but he is one of the fittest, healthiest human beings you will ever meet in your life. Loves triathlons. I think I might have seen George drink twice in 20 years, like to drunk point. You know, never. He's always eaten the right things, always done the right things. It's not, you know, it's, of course, there are things you can do to make your health better, and everybody should do those things, whatever that is. But as long as you're healthy, then, you know, the rest of it is just genetics. Exactly. Like, I don't know how else to put it. Sorry, Billy.
That's all right. Well, Chelsea, I'm excited to see your parade, and I'm excited that the Australian Fashion Week have really embraced this. I'm imagining there was a lot of work behind the scenes to get it up.
Yes. But I have to say, IMG events were really open to it. I was expecting, you know, I was sort of sweating going into the meeting thinking, oh, God, they're never going to let me do this. But they did. They just straight away, they didn't even bat an eyelid.
Poor Chelsea, that's the worst heckle ever, isn't it? That's second only to the little kid who said to David O'Doherty, when will this get good?
Chelsea, we can't wait to check out the parade. It's I believe the Australian Fashion Week is in May, so make sure that you do check it out. And of course, check out Chelsea's book, Body Image Warrior, which is still available on the website, Body Image
Warrior. And thank you so much for your advocacy.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. As a plus size person with daughters, thank you.
Yeah. And I will say there's been many people on our socials today also have said the work that Chelsea has done, as well as Taryn Brumford, excuse me, has been liberating to so many. Yeah, incredible. So thanks so much.
Good on you, girl.
Chelsea, and all the best with the parade.
Sorry about Billy. She's going to sleep now.
Broad Radio. Talking inspo we love, info we need, and sharing more of us. Watch and listen live every Tuesday 9 a.m. Australian Eastern Daylight Savings Time at broadradio.com.au, or find us on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube and LinkedIn at Broad Radio Oz. Talk to us live. Call on 1300 8 BROAD. Catch up on demand anytime, anywhere, every time, everywhere. On the train, we'll be here. 2 a.m. existential crisis? We've got you covered. Broad Radio. Here for more.
Well, Nellie, what often happens on this show is that a theme forms, which I never ever kind of plan, but it tends to just fall into place.
Today's the Nellie theme, mate. Like, seriously, I'm looking at this running order. It's just occurred to me. You've gone separation, you've gone plus size. Now we're going to talk chronic illness. This is like my whole life.
Well, I do often plan my co-host for people that are going to... I like to put people in areas where they're going to sing. So I'll get you to sing at the end of the show as
Appreciate
well.
Appreciate it.
But no, I think the theme that also is forming is around shame.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. And so let's keep the theme going, because I'm thrilled to welcome to Broad Radio a woman who is an advocate, mentor and coach for women who live with chronic illness, and she, as she describes herself, she is de-shaming chronic illness. Michelle, great to have you on Broad Radio. Can you tell us how you began working in this area? What made you decide, I'm going to mentor women like this?
Yeah, well, nobody expects to get chronic illness, and certainly nobody expects to be a chronic illness mentor. What happened for me is that I live with two chronic illness conditions, and through that process, I've had to navigate what I think of as the underworld of chronic illness. When you're bedbound, when you're, you know, really living with deep side effects from medication, when you're trying to work or maintain working while living with pain or brain fog or just the confusion and the emotional stress of living with chronic illness. So for me, I was really super clear that living with chronic illness did not mean that I couldn't be myself, and that I was going to use the experience to really be the most empowered person I could be on the planet. And as I did that, I found ways to support my own emotional well-being. I found ways to have very, very difficult conversations with, you know, my boss, with the organization I was working with family and friends, with what I think of as the unhelpful helpers who really want you to go to yoga or drink green juice as if that will solve your chronic condition. And as I did that, I was able to navigate my way through chronic illness and actually deepen my sense of connection to myself, really expand my boundaries, and be able to stand on what I think of as my very sacred ground. And so I had a job. I was working for the health department. I was running another business, Philosophy in the Pub, and women would come and talk to me about, they would disclose their experience of breast cancer. They would disclose their experience of chronic fatigue. They would ask me to help them to use some of the tools about how they saw me. And I would do that. And then over time, that's become my work and my business. And one of the reasons for that is that 47% of Australians live with chronic illness. And that's, you know, in the US, that's 133 million Americans. And it's actually quite normal to live in a body and experience chronic illness. And so when we have this conversation and we see that this is actually around us, even if it's invisible chronic illness, then we can have a conversation about how to navigate it in a way that's supportive, in a way that is expanding, in a way that includes love, meaningful work, and in ways that work for us and our bodies.
So, Michelle, I think, as I disclosed to you before, and it's a tricky one, this one, because I'm telling someone else's story, so I'm very conscious of not revealing too much detail. But my daughter was diagnosed with myalgic encephalomyelitis, which some of you will obviously know, Michelle, is known commonly as chronic fatigue syndrome, about 6 years ago. And the thing I've noticed entering an underworld is exactly the right description. The thing I've noticed is there's two prevailing narratives, I think. One of them is the tragic narrative of life is over, she will never recover, she will never have quality of life, a devastating narrative. And at the other extreme, there is a, this is all in your head. If you just drank turmeric lattes, she'd be fine. If you find the right health professional, as though we haven't tried hundreds, she'll be fine. You are exaggerating it. And there's very little middle ground. And trying to navigate that as a mum, let alone as my poor, beautiful daughter navigating that herself as a child, is one of the biggest difficulties of the experience. I wonder if you could speak to that.
Yeah. So the most important thing about living with chronic illness is that we need to have a story. We need to change the story, as you've so beautifully outlined. These are apparently the option. It's all over and it doesn't get better till you get well, or you just need to conquer this and push through. Neither of which serve it. The story that really actually works for us is to understand that there is a stripping down. And that's why I use the mythology of Persephone, who's the Greek goddess of Queen of the Underworld. But actually, there's a myth that's 2,000 years older. It's a Sumerian myth that comes from when the world was filled with the great feminine myths. And that is the story of Inanna and her sister Ereshkigal. But the important part of whatever way you get to this story is to understand that the stripping down is a way in which you can come so deeply inwards, and that when you can come inwards in a way where you can find your own foundation and floor, and you might need a little bit of help with that, then you can internally, emotionally, you can return and rise and engage with the world, with clinicians, without necessarily your physical body having to change. But it's the shaming of the story. It's a truly, absolutely rubbish story. And it's not just rubbish because it's not useful. It's rubbish because it's not true. You actually can have a life filled with love. You can have a life where you flourish. It will be a way in which it may not have looked to you before, but that doesn't change the fact that you can engage with your creativity, your intelligence, all in ways that work for you. And in fact, we've actually seen this. COVID has provided the best example of understanding for people. Like remote working, I worked remotely for 7 years for a government department. Nobody was working remotely. I had to very strongly set the boundary and say, this is how my capacity is and this is the way I can work. So I stopped talking about what I can't do, started talking about what I can do. And that then was such an unusual thing. But now apparently everybody's gotten over it and remote working is entirely possible for everybody, which changes the landscape for everyone.
Well, and Michelle, so just quickly, as is now remote schooling, which we've been able to navigate because of COVID. But sorry, Joe, you've got a question.
Well, so Michelle, you talk about changing the story for yourself in really powerful ways, but I imagine that's a daily practice. And I wonder, what does it mean practically speaking as you go about living with chronic illness?
So it is a daily practice, but it's very ingrained for me because I started for that position. And what that means practically is I am the decision maker in everything in relationship to my life, including my experience of chronic illness. I am taking advice from clinicians, but that's their role, is to advise me, and I'm the decision maker. That's not to say they don't have expertise, but I am the decision maker. It means that I share what boundaries are with family and friends, and it's simply, this is what I have capacity to do, or with employers, this is what is possible and I am following medical advice. And what I'm doing is sharing the expansion of that story with others so that I can get my very appropriate needs met, so that I can be supported in ways that work for me, and so that I am never apologizing for living with chronic illness.
We do not need to apologize for living with chronic illness. I'm just about jumping out of my chair because I have to say, Jo, do you notice Michelle's tone? Right? What I'm really trying to teach my daughter is that when she, you know, can only go to a birthday party for an hour or something, which is actually remarkable that she can even go where she's been from. But to say without apology, to not go, I'm so sorry, can I come between 6 and 7 and I'll bring a present and I'm really sorry, but I'll have to leave. But to go, I would love to come to your party, so I'm going to come at 7 and Mum's going to pick me up at 8.
Beautiful.
Full stop. No explanation, because I don't want her developing this narrative that she has to apologize for how she exists in the world. It is not her fault that she has a chronic illness.
And it's also the case that as women, we're trained to apologize. Yes. If you see a woman, we bump into another, we bump into a person, we apologize. So for the person living with chronic illness, that is a double whammy, and it's so culturally encoded. But, you know, I've written for Women's Agenda. There's an article out there you can find that you don't need to apologize with chronic illness, as well as heaps of resources on my Insta and webpage. Because the most important thing in that process is when you know that you are, you know, a whole human being, you're having an experience of chronic illness, but it does not define you, and it is not a fatal flaw in your moral character that you're living with chronic illness, then you've got somewhere to stand and speak from with ease.
Yeah.
It just destroys me that that it's not enough that you have to live with the chronic illness and all of the things that come with that, but you also have to process this shame. It just, you know, what is wrong with society?
Can I offer a theory and ask what Michelle thinks of this theory? So the theory that I have developed over this time is two things. Friends and family, in a broad sense, can't come close to the big feelings. So the idea of the narrative that, oh, you know, she can no longer play netball, or she might not go to uni when she's 18 or whatever, they can't come close to the big feelings, so they deny. Medical people, and I'm obviously being very, I'm generalising, but they can't cope with the fact that they can't control. So because they can't cure, they deny. Wonder what you think of that.
So the whole thing is about this use of chronic and illness. When we talk about illness, the traditional idea is you get sick, you get a little worse, you get better.
Yeah.
So that's what everybody's trained to, which is different to disability. Like disability, we're like, oh, okay, that's something you're living with for life. But the chronic bit seems to make it optional. It's really such a juxtaposition. And so I always think it's like, illness is part of my experience. I live in a biological, you know, I live in a body. We're all going to break down in our body. This is not actually something abnormal. And family and friends feel that there's this great loss and great grief of who you could have been.
Yes.
And they're very attached to that because they just want you to get better because you're ill, which is different to disability, which is not the case because now chronic illness is well and truly included in disability. And for clinicians, and certainly there are many out there who are incredibly supportive, their job is to make you get well, and we are changing that discussion about being supportive, which is why I talk about you are the decision maker. They are not driving this ship, you know? They're not the ones getting you well. You are the decision maker about what is supportive for you in this experience that you're having.
I'd like to mention too, one of the people, one of our lovely viewers slash listeners, Deb, she comments that it's such a true story for the disabled too. She shares her boundaries and her abilities with friends, family and clients and doesn't apologise for what she cannot do.
And the more people like Deb do that, the more we get used to doing that as well. And we see it and you're modelling it. Good on you, Deb.
I love it. So we are running over time as we always do. But Michelle, I want you to just very quickly explain. You do this 6-month course called Queen of the Underworld, which is just, I love it. Look at that image, Queen of the Underworld. It's so empowering. What do you guide people through in this course?
So we basically take you through all the different facets of your life. And we start with how do you navigate the unknown and uncertainty, because that's a huge part of living with chronic illness. But there is a map, and once you know how to navigate uncertainty and the unknown, then you've got a life skill. We look at the story of illness and we look at what's been inherited from family and friends, and we need to unplug you from that ancestral story so that you can write your own. Then we look at what I think of as the archetypes of power, but basically getting you into this position so that you have the great boundaries, so that you can have the conversation with clinicians, so that you can have the conversation with work. And then we look at all of your resources, your creativity, your intelligence. And just to give you one very quick example, I do work with women who are bedbound. I do work with women, you know, who are not out there able to go to the office as well as women who can. But I've got a beautiful young woman, very talented, who was a writer and lives with the same condition as Nell's daughter. And so she can't write because her body can't do that. But what we can do is support her to be a storyteller because she can tell stories. So her creativity can flourish in a whole new way. She's not locked out of life, but that is what we are doing through the process of the 6-month program, is just finding that way forward for you with all of your capacity as you are now.
Oh, the pivot. Before the pivot became a thing. Bless you, Michelle. I feel obviously it's personal to me, but I just feel so much better, even just speaking to you, honestly. Thank you for the work that you're doing.
It's really beautiful, Michelle. And do check out Michelle's podcast as well, The Pajama Interviews, which I love that as an image.
Writing it down.
And it's all about I love taking back the power. What is your story?
Yes,
I just think that's
story,
really, really
your body.
Powerful.
Yep.
Thank you so much, Michelle.
Thanks for having me.
Good on you, Michelle.
While we're talking about podcasts.
Yes.
You've got a podcast.
I have got a new one. It's called The Single Life of Us with Kate Mulholland, which some of you will know from Two Peas in a Podcast. Both of us, basically between us, we were married and or de facto for like 52 years. And we both, in the last couple of years, become single. And long story short, we're trying to challenge the narrative that it's all shit.
Uh-huh.
Right? Some of it's hard. Mm. Some of it's really hard. And a lot of it's great.
Mm.
And, you know, if I do say so, we're pretty funny.
You are funny.
We take a few calls. We do a bit of a laugh here and there.
That.
So, yeah, get on to it, hey?
Well, can I ask you the question that Claire asked that we weren't able to ask
Catherine
because we ran out of time?
Yeah.
But she says, do you find the grief factor of separation difficult?
Oh, absolutely. Mm. I mean, I'm definitely not rose-coloured glasses. It's all fine. But I do feel like there's a certain level of choice as well. Like I do find the grief is real, but I also choose not to exist only in grief. And grief is not linear. So you don't go, oh, I'm feeling grief and then eventually I'll never feel it. On some level, I think I'll grieve the idea of that relationship at least for the rest of my life. Mm. But is my whole life grief? Absolutely not. I mean, to be perfectly frank, I'm, you know, late 40s, I'm chubby, I'm, you know, I'm not 20, you know, but I am loving life, I'm dating, I am enjoying having my own bedroom, I love choosing my own sheets. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not sort of, I don't like the positive psychology movement, that's for another day, but I also do choose to focus on the positives out of it. I think myself, my ex-partner, my kids were actually all happier. So yeah, there's absolutely grief. I'm not saying there haven't been difficult moments and there'll continue to be, but there were difficult moments when I was in a relationship too.
Sure.
You know?
You don't escape that.
No.
No. Well, thank you so much. It's been, I mean, I don't even know what time it is. We're so over
time. It's only 6 minutes, darling. That's broad time. We broadened the time.
We control time.
Yeah.
Nellie, awesome as always. Thank you, darling. And we'll be back with Broad Radio next week.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.